Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. We have a wonderful friend and ally returning, Franklin Sanders. If you haven't checked out the Best of the Precious Metals Market Report at the Solari Report, I can't recommend it to you enough. Franklin joined me for many years. He lives in Middle Tennessee. I live in West Tennessee. He lives in Middle Tennessee. And he wears many hats. He's an educator, a scholar. He's got a newsletter called The Money Changer. If you haven't read it, please check it out. Some wonderful books we're going to talk about. And he used to have a precious metals dealer, and now his kids have a precious metals dealer, and he'll tell you all about it. He's also a pastor of a wonderful church in Westport, Tennessee, and I had the privilege of attending for many years. And he wears many hats, including doing a Bible ministry, which I think is one of the of all the things, amazing things you do, Franklin. It's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And I can't even tell them how many kids. You have 7 kids and how many grandchildren?
Just had number 18 grandchild. I've got 7 kids, number 18 grandchild on the 3rd of May. And number 19 is due actually about 6-8 days ago.
So. So I dare say you're a people investor too. Anyway, so Franklin, thank you for doing this. We're here to talk about the gold silver calculator, but I have some other topics I want to cover because everybody wants to know, you know, that everybody's got questions about gold and silver. So tell us how you're doing.
I'm doing fine. In 2016, I lost my wife of nearly 49 years, Susan, and which is, I easily admit, the worst blow I ever took in my life. But in July of 2018, I married again to a woman both Susan and I had known for 40 years. And right. She and her husband and I used to be partners. And they moved in 1996 to Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And during Hurricane Katrina, he was murdered there in 2005.
Right. I'll never forget that. That was a horrible, horrible event.
Yeah, it was. Well, it left her with 6 children, five of them still at home. And she's a brave woman. She's a brave and wonderful woman.
So Christmas between the two families must be a very interesting affair.
Big deal. Big deal. Lots of spending, lots of driving. Yes.
Okay, well,
she has 6 children and 7 grandchildren, so...
You know, you're growing.
I don't know how many we've got together.
Okay. So we're here to talk about the gold and silver calculator. I'm just going to pull it up and screen share to take a look at it. It's at silverandgoldourmoney.com. Can you see that, Justin? Let's see if that's coming up. No. Share screen. Here we go. Can you see that, Franklin?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Okay, so Franklin, this is your baby. You created the silver and gold payment calculator long ago, and you told me about it. I got all excited and said, we got to put it online. But let's start at the beginning. What inspired you to create the silver and gold payment calculator?
Well, I've got go back to a little bit of my history. The same year that I got married, just a little bit, actually maybe a month before I got married in 1967, I got a book that had some essays. It was called Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, and it had some essays by this fellow named Greenspan. And that was really my first introduction to gold and silver money. And of course, I've done a tremendous amount of research since then. But what I realized as I studied later was that we have a constitutional, a legal, a common law right to gold and silver money, but none circulates. You've got to go buy it from private individuals. The government doesn't mint and put into circulation gold and silver money. And so what to do? You need some sort of interface to go from the paper system to gold and silver. So in 19, 86, I started a gold and silver bank, and to create that interface so people could take their paper money, we'd put that into gold and silver form, and then when they wanted to pay in paper money, we'd write checks for them against their account. Of course, you know all about that. The IRS said that was a conspiracy to delay the IRS and all this other stuff. It never was anything of the kind. But anyway, we wound up with this big criminal trial that lasted a long time. After that, they double team their victims. And so they sent a man to work for the Tennessee Revenue Department, and they charged me under a law that nobody had ever been charged with in the 19 years that it had been on the books, delaying or depriving the state of revenue to which it's entitled. At the time, it's entitled there too. So, in other words, it was a prosecution for debt, and that's why they probably had never done it. So, anyway, I was convicted in that. We were all acquitted in the federal trial. I was convicted in that. And what you have to understand is this. Since 1913, when the Federal Reserve was created, the banking system has little by little squeezed gold and silver out of the monetary system.
Well, it squeezed it out of the retail monetary system, and it hasn't squeezed it out of the monetary system. Because if anything, they're accumulating and using it, you know, it's as important as ever.
Yes, exactly. At the central bank level, certainly international level, that's true. So they took the gold out in 1934. They took the silver out in 1967. And so what we're left with is a strange situation where we have a legal right to these things, but as a practical matter, it's very difficult to deal in gold and silver in your everyday life as money.
Right. It's not that liquid. It's not that liquid.
You know, and exactly. And what you have to understand is that Gresham's law works both ways. In other words, everybody knows what Gresham's law says. Bad money drives good money out of circulation. True, except it requires legal tender laws to do that. In other words, if people are free to use some other money, then what will happen is they will abandon the bad money and use the good money, and the good money will drive the bad money out of circulation.
So let me just stop you for a second and remind everybody that we're basically in the middle of a war, and the most important issue at the heart of that war, I say, is a spiritual war. But if you look at the material part of that war, this comes down to whether they print money, or they have a monopoly on money, or we can print money. And frankly, we don't need them to print money. So we're really talking about whether or not credit and money creation should be a monopoly held by secret bankers, you know, and used for secrecy. And the reason that's so important is if you look at the passport system they're trying to implement, they're talking about complete financial control, mark of the beast kind of system. And so at the very heart of this is the question of a monopoly on credit and money creation. That's what we're battling about, and that's why this is so important.
Well, I think let me just take what you said just a little bit farther. 86% of the banks in the world are working on digital central bank digital currencies right now.
Right.
And what that means is that you will have an account, and there won't be any other money you can use, and they'll have some kind of social credit system, so they score you whether you're a docile citizen or not. And if you're not a docile citizen, if you're one of those deplorables, they just turn the switch and cut you off. And people have to understand, money is freedom. Money is freedom.
Right.
The press is not free if you don't own one and if you can't buy one.
Right.
And so I've always talked about gold and silver as the only financial assets that are not somebody else's liability. They're the only non-dollar denominated assets. They don't depend on the dollar for their value. And so that's one of the reasons it's important to have them. But now what we're talking about facing these central bank digital currencies is that you won't be able to live unless you have something outside of that system.
Right.
So So there's a there's a defensive sense in which we want to use gold and silver, but there's an offensive sense too. And the offensive sense is, if we can get enough people using it, it will drive that paper money out of existence. I mean, it will drive it out of public use.
I wasn't going to show this, but if you'll bear with me, there's something I'd love to show you. So this is the head of the BIS in October 2020.
All our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
So it's real funny, because Carson's keeps being pretty, you know, blunt about what they're really up to.
Yeah. Well, complete control. And that's, you know, I tell people that, and I don't think they understand how serious that is.
Franklin, they do not understand how serious this is. They do not understand.
I mean, this is literally, you will not be able to buy or sell. They will try to take the cash out of circulation.
So no, this is worse than that, because what they're doing, the central banks with the financial core moving in and taking control of the whole fiscal policy. And the question, if they do that, is how can they enforce taxation without representation? And the way they can force taxation without representation is to be in a position to take all your assets, whatever they want.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
That's right.
And it's the World Economic Forum. They said it's 2030, you have no assets and you'll be happy.
Right. Or else.
Right.
You'll be happy or else.
Okay. So you got onto this pretty early. So tell us about the calculator. How did it come into being the first time?
Well, I think you have some blame for that too, because we started.
No, you already had it. You made it. I didn't. We put it online, but it already existed. You had made it.
Well, here's the thing. You can hold it as an app on your phone, and it's no more trouble than Venmo to make this calculation. And the calculator is extremely flexible. You can use any kind of gold or silver you have.
Uh-huh.
And it's not complicated. Anybody can figure it out and use it. And that's exactly what we want. I mean, literally, it can be used around the world because it has the ability to use, 140 currencies, 114
currencies. Let me show you. So it's at the bottom, you can say, okay, I want to use gold and silver. You can say, I want to use all gold. You can say, I want to use all silver. So let's say, Franklin, you want to give one of your kids $1,000 in gold or silver. And let's say you say, okay, I want gold and silver. And here, it's not, I think it's about 20 currencies plus Bitcoin. So it's about 20 currencies in Bitcoin. And you can put in the amount that you want, and you can specify ounces or grams, because in some markets it's grams. You know, people use grams and ounces. And the other thing you can do is you can add a premium. We know if we went to a dealer and bought gold or silver, you know, we'd likely pay some premium over melt value. So we put in a capacity because some people using it wanted to do a premium. And then and this is a function if you want to pay all in gold and 90% silver. So let's just hit that. And what comes up is we need to pay 1/2 ounce gold coin, and in 90 ounce silver, we need to pay $50 in face value. Or if we use, we can switch it to a 1 ounce coin and do 1 ounce in a silver coin and then in the local currency, right?
Right, right.
So it's just a simple way. We've got the desktop version now. We're working on a iPhone and Linux phone apps. We won't do an Android one. We'll do an iPhone and a Linux phone. Anyway, but I just tell people, I'm getting ahead of myself. So we made a calculator. When was the first one?
Oh, I think it was 10 years ago or more. It was
a while ago. People started to use it, and one thing led to another. We had some serious website problems. We lost a whole website, and we finally just last year got our Soliri.com up, and then I said to you, you know, I want to bring up the calculator, and so we started. Now, at the top, tell us about the gold-silver ratio. There's something here. We have the gold price, we have the silver price, but then we have the gold-silver ratio. What's that?
Well, if you look, the gold-silver ratio is the price of gold divided by silver, which is to say it's how many ounces of silver it takes to buy 1 ounce of gold. And if you go back through history, that's a very stable, relatively a very stable relationship. And it's only since governments have demonetized silver since about 1870. It's only since then that the ratio has varied wildly, and wildly is the word. If you had a chart that was 16 feet long, all but about the last 8 inches would show that ratio in a range of 2.5 to 16. And it's only late after 1873 that the ratio ever climbs above that. Right. And it's interesting that the ratio, the two highs were in 1941 and 1991, 50 years apart, and they were at 100 ounces to one. And then the ratio always, it goes up and then it goes way back down again. And it has a habit of returning to 16 to one. This is a chart that goes back to 1980. It shows the ratio back to 1980. And it actually went below that number that's there. This is a monthly chart, but it actually went back under 16 to 1. And you see that the majority of the trading takes place really below 85 to, between 85 to 1 and about 46 to 1. Uh-huh. And then last year, we got a 5,500-year homily in that the ratio went up to 125. I mean, it's just impossibly high. So it's started back down steeply since then. And what we try to do with the ratio is we try to, you see that there are these big swings on the ratio from the top to the bottom. Uh-huh. And you go from, say, 100 to 1 down to 46 to 1. Well, if you take your gold and trade it for silver up at the top, where you get a 100 ounces of silver for your 1 ounce of gold, and then when it goes down to 45, or let's just say 50, you swap back into silver, then you end up with twice as many ounces of gold as you would have had if you just held on to the gold.
Right.
So using the ratio, trading the ratio at those extremes, gives us the ability to increase the number of ounces that we hold. This is the ratio chart since 1990. If you look at if you zoom in just a little bit and look at the chart, you see since 1999, you see that kind of 85 to 46 range,
right,
where most of the trading takes place. And then it blew up. Well, let me go back. First, in 2011, when there was a wild gold and silver rally from the lows in 2008, there was this huge rally. The ratio went to 85 to 1 in 2008. And then it dropped like a rock all the way down to 32. And we had all of our customers traded out at that time. Now, we didn't get, all of my customers didn't get that whole distance, but they got a good piece of it. So then it turned around and started going back up, and it went from 32, it says on this chart 113, because this is a monthly chart, but that's a huge move. So we were in gold, we traded back into gold at 32, and we were going all the way up, so the gold at the top would buy 125 ounces of silver. We have been swapping out of gold into silver all that time.
Right.
And now you can see, let me go to the next chart just to make this point clear. You can see that whole trend up from 2011 has peaked. It peaked this year and has crashed. The ratio is about 50% of what it was.
That's an enormous move.
A year and a half ago.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, it's huge. Yeah. So what we try to do is to exploit this ratio to make it work for us. And that red arrow down there at 30 is our target for our next swap from silver into gold. So it's a strategy. I don't understand, Catherine, why everybody doesn't do this. It's a mystery to me.
Oh, I can tell you why. I can tell you why they don't do it. Because mailing and shipping, and in other words, you got people who truly are buy and hold. Mm-hmm. And they'll do this if they'll trade an ETF, but they won't do this if they're doing coins.
Well, that's a very costly neglect, because the ratio trade works, and we stay in physical gold or silver all the time. We're never out of it. We're just trying to make the most of it.
Right.
So, and you know, you had asked, well, why did I stop trading gold and silver? That is my business, and why did my sons take it up? And the answer is continuity.
Right.
I have some customers that have been with me for 40 years, and a lot of them follow that gold silver trading strategy. And as I said, most dealers don't do it, or else they want to do it in such a way that the transaction costs are simply huge.
Right.
And so for continuity, one of the reasons that my sons wanted to do the business and I wanted them to is so that we've got continuity across the generation. So
now, are they still doing the monthly savings?
Yes, they do the monthly acquisition plan. Right. Mm-hmm.
So you used to call it the MAP, and I would love it if you would just tell people about it, because we're encouraging people to get together and do circles, and I think this is a great thing for a circle to do.
Well, the way it works, we have this monthly plan, and we charge $12 a year to administer it. And what we do is we pool a bunch of orders on the 15th of the month, and then all of those people get the same commission rate as if they had bought $10,000 worth.
Right.
Then we actually ship it to them. And it's a good way to make.
Now, what's the smallest amount of money you can do in this savings plan? So I used to do $100 a month.
Right. Well, it's $300 now.
It's $300 now. So $300 a month. If you just commit to do $300 a month, you're just going to get $300 of silver once a month, right?
Silver or gold or both.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And, you know, it's interesting that on that plan, there's a $300 minimum, but we've had people on that plan who've done $25,000 a month.
Right.
And it just gives them a regular way to save in gold and silver.
Right.
And over time, that dollar cost averaging really works out.
Okay, so I'm going to go back and pull up the calculator again. So the reason I wanted to do this, I don't know if you've ever talked with somebody who's been part of a community currency system. So a couple of years ago, we interviewed the guy who started Ithaca Hours. And it takes an incredible amount of work, Franklin, to create an organization and create bylaws and deal with the issues of risks and what are the politics going to be of upsetting the central bankers and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the complexity is just mind-boggling. And, you know, and I took one look at the calculator and I said, well, you don't need an organization. You don't need bylaws. You just need to do it. You just need to get a group of businesses and people together and just say, okay, we're just going to use our coins.
Right.
You just do it. Just do it.
And you know what the advantage of it is? The advantage of it is they're going to acquire gold and silver through their business at prices much lower than if they went out and bought it.
Right.
And so there's a benefit. There's a benefit for both sides, for the person who buys and the person who sells. And the good thing about taking gold and silver in trade is that instead of taking dollars, which are a depreciating currency, you're taking in gold and silver, which are an appreciating currency.
Exactly. And, you know, I did that. You inspired me to do that thing where I showed how much float there was in a community and how much value they had lost by taking and circulating dollars. It was incredible. They had lost half of their wealth. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so why not reverse that? You know, it's really the truth to say we forge our own chains. We forge our own monetary chains.
It's true.
There's nothing at all legally preventing us from using gold and silver and completely escaping their system.
Exactly. So up here on the calculator, you can click on the gold table. And you had this one, you did this on the first one. And this, why don't you describe what's the list on the gold table, gold equivalents?
Well, you have to understand that until 1970, 1968 when the Krugerrand came out, there were no even weight gold coins. And there were various weights, like, you know, the $5 gold piece is not a quarter of an ounce, it's 0.2418, and there are historical reasons for that. But in 1968, the South Africans began to mint the Krugerrand, which was an exact 1 ounce of gold, exact ounce of gold. And so they did that. Other countries began to follow. And then in, 78 or 81, the South Africans came out with a half ounce, exact half, exact quarter, exact 10th ounce coin. And so everybody, all the other national mints that were trying to get into the act, all did the same thing. They all minted this series of coins. The problem is that when they sold them, they sold those smaller coins at increasing premiums.
Right.
So you had to pay a lot more for them.
Right.
And all of this is just to avoid making a simple mathematical calculation, because an Austrian, you know, gold is gold is gold. It doesn't matter what the form is.
Right.
And so an Austrian one ducat, for instance, has 0.1106 ounces of gold. Well, I just multiply that by the gold price to find out what it's worth. So, and it has a very low premium. So all of these coins potentially are available in the market. And it doesn't matter which ones you have, you can find them on this chart. And believe it or not, I've seen, I guess, every one of these over time.
Well, so anyway, so these are the gold coins that you will, if you're going to hold coins, and you're going to hold coins that are, you know, that are priced, you know, as close to melt value as possible. So you want to pay as little premium as possible. What this chart does is it shows you the commonly used gold coins. It shows you what the amount, the content of gold is, whether it's 1 ounce in a Cougarand or the smaller amount as you described in the ducat. And then it multiplies it by the current spot price. So you can see what the melt value of your coin is. And I always used to tell clients when I was an investment advisor, you know, you want to pay the lowest premium over melt value. And the way to do that is to go talk to a dealer, but have this chart up so you can calculate quickly what premium he's charging you, right?
I got to put in a footnote. Sorry. I had a customer, longtime customer, call me yesterday, and he said, listen, I've got this lady friend. She's an older lady, and these people out in California are trying to sell her gold, and it doesn't look like a good deal to me, but would you take a look at it for me? And I said, sure, I'd be glad to. And one of the things that you have to understand is that these people always price gold in furlongs per fortnight so that you can't possibly figure out what they're charging you. That is, most people can't. And they were selling this woman quarter ounce something or other, something obscure. And all you have to do is just divide the cost by the content. So right. I divided the $800 and some odd they were charging her by the content. They were charging her $3,200 some odd an ounce when gold was at $1,900.
Right.
So your advice was pretty good.
Right. Well, you taught me pay as close to melt value as possible. And, you know, you've got to understand the premiums you're paying. I remember I had one horrible fight with a client who wanted to buy one of the ETFs at a 24% premium to melt value. And I called you, it was silver. And I think 90% silver was going at a melt value of 2.5% at that time.
Yeah.
So it's much higher right now. But, you know, she wanted to pay, she was getting talked into paying. And I, you know, I've shown you dealers who on numismatics were charging 50 to 100% markup. But 3,000% is the biggest I've seen. Okay, so the silver equivalence table is just the same. It's the silver coins with the content, you know, multiplied by the melt value. Now, one thing I wanted to point out was we give an option here to use all 90% silver or 90% silver, a one ounce silver coin. Could you, for people who don't know, could you explain what 90% silver is?
Yes. The U.S. dollar is the coin of the realm in the United States, and it was made so by the Coinage Act of 1792. But it doesn't have an ounce of gold, of silver in it. It's a little more than 0.75 ounces. Well, because for decades following that 1792, the price of silver rose against gold, they couldn't keep silver coin in circulation. And so they reduced the amount of silver in the coin in the 1850s so that there's about 9% less silver in 10 dimes than there would be in one silver dollar coin. So that the silver coins, the United States minted vast amounts of them over the years. And there's 0.715 ounces in a dollar, a little bit less than a quarter of an ounce. But it was the primary and preferred means of investing in silver for years and years and years. And I still like it the best because it's the most divisible form right. of silver.
Right.
But right now, there's a gold and silver buying panic going on. And whenever that happens, it drives up the price. And so that coin at wholesale in, say, December of 2019 probably cost us at wholesale about 30 to 50 cents an ounce over its gold content. In other words, I mean, over its silver content, very, very little markup at all. Well, now, today, I'll be doing good to buy that for $3.50 an ounce over spot.
Wow.
So that's... that's the reason we put that.
So what's the premium? What's the premium on a 1 ounce round compared to 90%?
At wholesale, $3.
Wow.
Unless you want to wait till September, in which case it's $2. It's huge.
It is huge.
See, when everybody in the world tries to go through that little narrow door into the gold and silver markets, which are very small, they can't get there. The price goes up and delivery stretches out. So, and that bothers me. I don't like waiting 14 weeks to get delivery on an item, not in the world we live in today, but you know, there's just not much else you can do.
So basically in the mid 90s, you were a little bit ahead of me, you and Susan. You said something's really wrong. We got to get out of the city and out of the land and build something that's more self-sufficient. You know, and then I came along a few years afterwards and met you and started to learn from you. But if you look at all the people flying into Tennessee over the last year, it's like they suddenly got the vision. So you've been working. We've had Senator Frank Nicely on the Salary Report. You've written him up several times in the Money Changer. He's one of the really outstanding leaders in the Tennessee State Legislature. But you've been working with him for many years to cancel the sales tax on gold and silver, because that's one of the impediments to using gold and silver as a currency is if you got a state sales tax, and not many states do, but there are some. So tell us a little bit about what you've been doing in that view.
Well, you know, we've tried a number of times to get the sales tax removed. 39 states do not have the sales tax on gold and silver. I don't know why we haven't been able to do it in Tennessee. The bill's in there again this year to try to remove the tax. Senator Nicely is with a group of other legislators. In the last 10 years, has really had a program to restore freedom in Tennessee. It's just astounding.
He's done incredible
what they've done.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah. And we worked with him, of course, on legalizing raw milk. How silly does that sound? Legalizing raw milk. We worked with him to legalize raw milk and to change the regulations on how many chickens you could kill on your own place. The state ag department was saying that you couldn't kill even one.
I don't know if I ever told you, I had a huge fight with Rob Kirby about the 20,000 chicken slaughter provision. Yeah. He was saying, you know, I said, I don't know how it came up, but I was trying to tell him about what you were doing with the chickens. Because if a farmer can slaughter 20,000 chickens a year, he's got himself a cash business. If a farmer can have a cash business, then you can have a local food system. Anyway, so Kirby was telling me that my problem was I didn't understand what was important and derivatives were the big problem. I said, no, it's much more important that we can slaughter 20,000 chickens a year, because then we can do something about the derivatives.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or then we won't be subject to what the derivatives do to the
exactly.
economy.
Exactly.
You know, just another footnote about the 20,000 chickens. I testified before the Ag Committee in 2005 when we were trying to get raw milk legalized. And this is the truth. With only seven cows, a farmer can cash flow $90,000 a year back then on the milk from those seven cows. And, you know, what it means is small farmers who are more efficient than industrial farmers, small farmers have a niche. They can make a living.
Right.
And better still, nutrient-dense, pure food is available to the public.
Right.
So it's a win-win situation every way.
Well, except for this, politically, people who get good nutrition are more ornery, Franklin. You know that. Okay, now one of the things that you taught me was the unbelievably powerful connection between food and local currency and local money. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, actually, I'm going to have to tell you that I owe my understanding of this to Senator Frank Nicely.
That's true.
Just very briefly, let me explain that until 1917, in the United States, most of the currency circulation was local.
Right.
That is, the farmers raised food, they sold it to people in the cities, they went to the city or the town and they bought hardware and coffee and salt and whatever else they need. And so there was a cash flow that went round and round. Plus, farmers were actually bringing money into the community when they sold their crops.
Right.
In addition to that, farmers did not go off the farm for their motive power. They raised their own mules or horses, and they raised their own fuel. About a third of their land was devoted to straw and grain for the animals. So it was not a completely closed system, but it was a fairly closed system where each community was more or less self-sustaining. And what happened in 1917, the Fordson tractor was introduced.
Right.
And that was the first tractor that was relatively cheap. So farmers started buying these tractors, and what that meant was they could plant more area faster. And so they bought the tractors. Well, it also meant that they were sending money out of their community off to Detroit to pay for
right.
the tractor. Then they were sending money out of their community off to New York to pay for the fuel.
Right.
And now, all of a sudden, they've got to go outside their local economy and bring in more money every year because there's a drain out of the economy.
They're on the treadmill.
And this was great in 1917. Think right. about what was going on in 1917. There was a world war, and that farmers could sell anything they could raise at the highest price.
Right.
Well, what happened in 1920? The agricultural depression hit, the post-war agricultural depression hit, prices collapsed, but the note on the tractor did not collapse. It did not go away, and the need for fuel did not go away. So what did farmers do? Before, they had planted hedgerow to hedgerow. Now they ripped out the hedgerows and planted them too and grew more and more. And so, of course, that glut made the agricultural depression worse. And
right.
that glut continued all the way into the 1930s. It certainly contributed to the depression, because the wealth of the world comes from the things men take out of the ground.
Right.
And most of that is agriculture. That's the only place we get something for free.
Right.
You throw the seeds out there, God sends the rain, God sends the sunlight, it grows up, you get something for free. You plant
right.
two bushels and you get back 200 bushels. And so as that agriculture production, that production off the ground, is transmitted through the economy and it's processed through the economy, every dollar's worth creates about $7 worth of
right.
gross domestic product. But what happens is farmers, when they get less and less and less for their produce, then that suddenly you have to replace that lost income. And the way that it was replaced is by debt. And that's what's happened for the last
And it's not just the tractor.
60, 70, 80 years.
The tractor came in 1917. The Fed came in the 1913. And
right.
so they're getting played on both sides of the balance sheet. It's what happened.
Right. Right. So the thing is, people say, oh, well the federal government, the Agriculture Department, pursued a policy from the end of World War II, and that policy was get big or get out.
Right.
They encouraged industrial farming, which is capital intensive, a lot of equipment, pesticides, herbicides. And so they actually encouraged that. Now, there's a false presupposition there that bigger is better, because that's not true. Maximum efficiency with a farm probably comes about 250 acres. Charlie Walters told me. Charlie has passed away now, but he used to publish Acres USA. And there's no efficiency like a man that owns his own ground
right.
and works it and knows it. And so, but those people have been driven out of business, and farms have been concentrated, and the federal government subsidizes those farms. Well, what that means is they're subsidizing bad food. Right. They're subsidizing GMOs. Right. They're subsidizing glyphosate use.
Right.
And if you look at the health of the American people, the rise of autoimmune disease, obesity, blood, diabetes, high blood pressure, all of those things, they come from the food supply.
Right.
That's where they come from. So what can you do? Here's what you can do. $2,400 a year. Do you know what that number signifies, Catherine?
Yeah.
$2,400 a year is what each and every American, man, woman, and child, spends on food and drink every year. Now, if local farmers can capture some of that cash flow so that we buy food from them, meat, vegetables, milk, so forth, we buy food from them, then we start that local current,
yeah, but you know why we don't
flow.
Why we don't buy food from them? It's got nothing to do with economics. So if you look at where I live in Hickory Valley, you've got these great dairy farms that were put out of business by the rules, by the regulations, which were designed not to make the food safe, but to make the food centrally controlled. And so I got all these neighbors who are on food stamps, and they wouldn't need food stamps if they could just, you know, whether it was slaughter the chickens or run a dairy, a raw milk dairy, there'd be plenty of cash. They'd all have jobs. They wouldn't need food stamps. They wouldn't need Social Security disability. They wouldn't need welfare. They wouldn't have these high health care bills, on and on and on. I mean, the system's not economic. It's just engineered with the federal credit. So we get a lot of questions about what it's like to move out on the land and to homestead. And you happen to have two of the best books, I think, on what it's like to do that. Could you just mention them? Are they still available for sale at your website?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. You're talking about At Home in Dogwood Mudhole.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Actually it's three volumes. And now, you know, Catherine, something happened. Some vandal without a face took down the website. But they can send me an email and I can take care of that. But it's the story of what we underwent when we moved out to the country and tried to make a living. And we didn't know anything about farming or homesteading or anything like
that. You were city folk.
We were just, that's exactly right. But we just wanted an agrarian lifestyle.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, we killed a lot of animals getting there. And we made
mistakes. The first time I asked you that question, how'd you learn how to farm? You said to me on the Salir report as many years ago, you said you killed a lot of animals. And I thought, okay, everybody in California just fainted.
Well,
anyway, those books are really, they are funny. They are fun. They are really, you know, they're just great books. And it tells the story. So they've got the same name. It's part one, part two, part three.
Yeah.
Okay.
Volume 1, 2, and 3, At Home in Dogwood Mudhole. Yeah.
And you really do live, there really is a Dogwood Mudhole.
Yeah, very near my house. There is, as a matter of fact, on
the National Trust. Is your house technically in Dogwood Mudhole, or is it technically in Westport?
Nah. Well, it's technically in Wayne County. Because there's no town where Dogwood Mudhole is. In West Point, there's not much of it left either.
Well, Dogwood Mudhole is the street or the town.
No, it's just a little place on the
right, on
the Natchez Trace. It's just the nearest place to us on the Natchez Trace.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so now your kids have a precious metals dealership, and they can ship. They don't ship in Tennessee, I'm assuming, but they ship everywhere else,
because of the tax. But they do, yes. It's called Volunteer Precious Metals. And they can talk to anybody who answers the phone.
Okay.
We all can.
And you still have the Money Changer, which to me is a great newsletter. So tell people how they can get the Money Changer.
Well, they can go to the-moneychanger.com. Don't. Be sure that you don't leave the dash out, because if you do, it goes to a porno site that I have nothing whatsoever to do with.
Know that?
Yes, that's one of the wonderful things about life. Anyway, they can order it there off of the website. And also, Catherine, I publish a daily commentary about the gold and silver markets, and that's free. And if they go to the-moneychanger.com, they can sign up there. And it's, I publish it about usually 4 or 5 days a week.
Okay. Well, you know, it's great because I love both in the Money Changer and in your daily commentary, you're mixing up precious metals with food, with resilient living, with getting away from Mr. Global. an occasional what I call project laughingstock. So just tell us, Franklin, because I think, you know, in the last year, a lot of people have come to understand what you've been saying for many years. With the pandemic, what happened to, you know, your audience and your audience for the Money Changer? What was your interaction with the general public as a result of the pandemic?
Well, let me confess that I personally had a very bad reaction to it. You know, I mean, I was looking at the whole world giving up its freedom, and it cast me down for a long time. And I finally said, wait a minute, you can't do this, because God's still in charge, and he's going to use this too for some good thing. And, but what I found was that the people who I deal with, who are not, you know, exactly a cross section of America, but they fought against that pandemic and all the lockdown all the way.
Yeah.
And I think they were right doing it, because the whole thing is a scam.
Yeah.
And when I say it's a scam, I know you know this, but I think for your listeners' benefit, they ought to know that we're not talking about a conspiracy theory that we claim to have discovered deep in the Amazon somewhere. This is all open source stuff.
I mean, well, go 30, to the World 34% Economic Forum. 34% of these small businesses in America have been shut down. That's what these guys, they want complete control. You know, this is a war between the people who can print money and the people who can earn money. And they want to put the earners out of business, grab their market share. And that's why, to me, the silver and gold payment calculator is so important. Because if you're going to not be a slave, because that's what they want with these passports. I don't know if you've looked at what they're trying to do with the passports, but they're trying to make it so, you know, they move everybody onto a smart grid. They come out with digital currencies, and they have complete control of every transaction. You know, you can't, if they say you can't go further than 5 miles from your home, you can't go further than 5 miles from your home.
Right.
You can't transact outside that range.
It's hard for a lot of people to believe that level of malevolence and totalitarianism. It's hard for some people to believe that anybody would want that kind of power, but it's absolutely true. These people are, I have to tell you, they're purely evil. It's evil to want to tyrannize the rest of humanity.
Well, but slavery, if you look historically, slavery has been the most profitable business where you could get it to work. And if you look at the problems they had with slavery the last time, digital technology has solved those problems, they think. So they think they're...
Well, but what the end of this, though, is the abolition of man.
Yes.
The end of it is complete dehumanization. And it's not surprising that Klaus Schwab links this to transhumanism. They want to make humanity some sort of cross between computers or technology and biology. They want to abolish man. They don't like man.
Bill Gates had so much fun loading an operating system into your computer and then making you update it with viruses. He thought he'd do the same with your body and your brain. Right? It worked with your laptop. Let's do it with him. So the shocking thing to me, I was not shocked, because I've done a lot on the Salieri Report about entrainment and mind control. So I was not shocked to see some of the population kind of disappear into the scam. What did shock me, Franklin, you know, and you and I have talked a lot about the effort they have to get the churches financially dependent on the government and get the churches controlled. But I have been shocked by the churches. I have been shocked by the number of preachers who've gone along with this. And I just watched a video one guy I love in New York, Tim Keller. On June 2020, he got cancer, and so he's been in treatment, and he's sort of been out of things, but they got him on TV the other day and had him pushing the vaccination. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that Tim Keller was pushing the Mark of the Beast.
Well, here's what, that's one of the things that cast me down the most last year, was that the church just went along uncritically with whatever the state said. And you just think about this for a minute, Catherine, put it in perspective. In past centuries, what was the first thing people did whenever there was a plague that came to their communities? They went to church. Right. They prayed to God to avert the plague. Right. Here, everybody is told not to go to church. The image of God is covered up with a mask. And so what happens is that people were taught to fear death more than they fear God. Right. You know, we're all going to die sometime or the other. But do you want to give up everything else before you die? I mean, that just, it was just crazy. I just couldn't believe that the churches would go along that way.
So
and
my
number, still doing it.
My number one story in economy and financial markets for 2020 was the war on God. And the reason I had it in the economy and financial section is I realized you can't create a liquid currency outside of the controlled system, except with people who have a spiritual grounding in life. You know, there's a reason it says in God we trust on the dollar bill. There is a connection between our commitment to a moral life and to freedom by divine authority and our ability to achieve financial liquidity.
There's a Swiss philosopher from the 19th century, Henri Frédéric Amiel, who said, if liberty is to be saved, it will not be saved by doubters or materialists or men of science, but by men who believe that God wills men to be free.
Right.
And you know that you have the desire for freedom, the desire for humanity itself has to be grounded in a trend outside of time and space.
Right, it has to be transcendent. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And if you lose that, you're not a human being anymore. That's the terrible thing about it. That's why I say it is the abolition of man. Right. That's what the intent of it is.
That is the intent. So one of the reasons I love always talking to you, Franklin, is because you understand the connection between spirit and food and money, among other things. Okay, well, we're still testing the calculator. You've got your network testing it. With this, we're going to invite some of our network to go out there. It's silverandgoldourmoney.com. And we invite you to test it. You can link to support and give us feedback. But anything else you want to say about the calculator before we close, Franklin?
Well, just this. I'd like to encourage people to use gold and silver in their daily business. If you've got a business, put a little sign up that says, we take gold and silver.
Right.
And then make the prices such that it's a little bit advantageous for them to pay in gold and silver. And just see if it works.
Right.
Because I know that it will work. But, you know, a lot of one of the problems that we all have is that we see all these things that need to be done. And we say, oh, somebody ought to do that. But we don't get around to doing them ourselves.
Right.
And that's where it has to start. If you're really not serious about wanting to see these things accomplished, if you're not willing to undertake some of it yourself.
So let's just do it. There you go.
It's just that simple.
Okay, well, Franklin, thank you. The motorcycles are coming by the house. Thank you very much for joining me on the Salieri Report. Thank you very much for creating the silver and gold calculator. I know it's made a difference so far. I think it has the potential to change the world. So I this time we launch it out and we send it out with your prayers. Okay.
Okay. Thanks so much. And God bless you for your part in it.
Have a great day, Franklin. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Love to everybody.